Blog Talk Radio.
On Book Show. I assume all of you guys have been watching the debates, the Republican debates. I mean, what a god-awful mess, a real disaster. I want to spend time today trying to analyze how to approach watching these debates, how to approach these candidates, how to evaluate them, how to determine who one should support and who one should not support. And let me start by saying that it's hard, very hard, and to try to decide, between these candidates, between any candidates in election, but particularly in this election. And that it makes complete sense that there's significant disagreement between rational people about who the right candidate should be and about who to support, about who is going to do a better job, and there are a number of things that are going on. One is that that these candidates are all mixed, that it's hard to tell whether what they're going to do, given what they're saying, that is, how many of them are actually going to execute on anything that they say. It's hard to predict the future. It's hard to predict how they would act once they actually get into office. So this is tough. Disagreement makes sense. And, we should respect that disagreement. We should recognize the difficulty here. And we should recognize that among rational people, this is a topic, more so than many other topics, where disagreement is legitimate and where disagreement is just. So let's try to evaluate or try to talk a little bit about how one should approach this issue, how one should approach evaluating them. And then I'd also like to hear from you. So call in, let me know what you think. I mean, are there any Trump supporters out there? 347-324-3075. What do you guys think of Ben Carson? Anybody there excited about Ben Carson? Or I know there are probably a lot of Ted Cruz fans out there. Call in 347-324-3075. We're talking about the Republican primaries. We're talking about the Republican candidates. We're talking about how to evaluate them and how to assess who one should vote for and who one should support, who one should advocate for, who you should try to argue for. So call in 347-324-3075. Now, when you call in, you have to, I think, press 1 to kind of get on the queue for questions, because otherwise all I see is your phone number, but I don't know who is just calling in to listen to the show and who's calling in to actually ask a question or make a comment. So if you have any ideas about this, call in. So let's try to think and think aloud. I'm thinking aloud here, but how one would go about evaluating a Republican candidate, and let's start off, or any presidential candidate for that matter, let's start off with this statement: none of these guys are going to be objectivists, right? And none of them are pure free marketers. And indeed, if they were, or any of them were, or somebody in the chat said, "You're on, Brooke, you should run," right? If I ran, I'd lose. I mean, I wouldn't get 1%. I wouldn't be up on even up there on the stage. So our ideas, the ideas of true laissez-faire capitalism, the ideas of objectivism, certainly are not popular enough to be able to even get up on the stage of the debate, never mind actually win an election. And a big barrier would be the fact that we're atheists. Although if I was running for president, I wouldn't actually say I was an atheist. I would say religion has and should have no bearing on the decision of whether to vote for me or not. That what you should ask me about is my political philosophy. But on issues like abortion and on issues like stem cells and on a bunch of maybe even gay marriage, on a bunch of these issues, I would alienate the religious right. So, you know, that would be the beginning of the end for candidacy. And it's amazing. You've got, I don't know, 17 Republican candidates or had 17 Republican candidates. Not one of them, I don't think, not a single one of them was pro-abortion. So, I mean, that tells you a lot about kind of the litmus test that you have to go through in the Republican Party. So let's start with the fact that a true free market person cannot win. And even somebody who is relatively free market is probably going to hide that fact. And you can really see that with Rand Paul, who is desperately trying to moderate his views, even on areas where he's very good, like government spending. Like I believe he's deep down pretty good on Medicare and on Social Security. But in this last debate, you couldn't tell. I mean, Rand Paul sounded like a mainstream Republican when it came to Medicare. We need to save Medicare for the, you know, all the nonsense. So, you know, so you have to take into account the fact that to some extent they're hiding their true beliefs. The better ones, the better presidential candidates are probably hiding their true beliefs when those beliefs are so radical that they think they would hurt them. So how do we evaluate? What's the principle by which you're evaluating these candidates? We should evaluate these candidates and determine who to support. Well, I think the fundamental is, are they overall, you know, in the aggregate of their positions, and this is what makes it tricky, right? Because in the aggregate of their positions is a tricky way to approach it. Are they in the aggregate of all their positions going to move us towards greater freedom or less freedom? Or if you want to be more pessimistic, you could put it as, are they in the aggregate of their various positions going to slow down our deterioration towards statism, or are they not? Who is going to slow us down more? Who is going to move us, if you're more, who's going to move us towards freedom, even if it's just a little bit? I don't think any of these guys is going to move us a lot towards freedom. But is there anybody here who, in the aggregate, and I would add, over the long term, is there anybody in the aggregate over the long term who's going to move us more towards freedom than any of the other candidates? That, I think, is the significant way to view this. So, you know, and there are a number of issues, I think, that you then have to think about, right? So let's list some of those issues. To me, one of the most important issues of this campaign and this presidential election, because for the first time in American history, I think this is an issue, is the issue of free speech. Because for the first time in American history, I think, there is a real movement out there on the left and to some extent on the right, Fox News, for example, to restrict free speech and to blame the people. To blame the people who are pushing the envelope, for example, drawing cartoons, for inciting violence against them. Now, that's new. That's never happened in American history. So I think there's certainly free speech is a huge issue. And I've talked about this in the past, but if we lose our ability to speak, particularly people like me and many of you who are listening to this show, we are radicals. Our speech will quickly be defined as hate speech if hate speech laws allowed to survive. Now, luckily, we have a First Amendment, so I think this is a long-term threat. But a president who is ambivalent, like George Bush was, like Clinton was, like Bush Sr. was, like Obama is, clearly move us away from support for free speech, and therefore make it more likely that one day in the future somebody will indeed, some Supreme Court will indeed be willing to make exceptions for the First Amendment. So attitude towards free speech is to me a huge, huge issue. And let me just say that on this issue, from what I know and from what I've seen of the candidates, Ted Cruz is by far the best of all of them. He is clearly a strong advocate for free speech and for many of the right reasons. So he makes an articulate case for this. And one of the reasons I still give, you know, kind of any kind of semblance of support to or still willing to consider Ted Cruz is this issue, is the issue of free speech. Okay, so that's one. That's a big one. What's the second one would be the economy, broadly speaking. I would broaden it beyond that. I would call it economic rights. The whole issue of rights is applied to the economic sphere. And here we're talking about, for me, the most important issue is regulation. Is there anybody who is willing to take on the question of regulation, the right of the government to regulate our businesses, to regulate us in a preemptive way, to intervene in voluntary transactions? Is anybody willing to actually talk about real deregulation, not re-regulation, but real deregulation, the elimination, the real doing away with whole regulations? I would start with Dodd-Frank and go backwards and just eliminate them one at a time, all of them, right? So is there any Republican candidate willing to do that? So that's one issue with regard to economic freedom. The other one is taxes. Now, this is a funny one because all of them are willing to talk about taxes. That is a favorite Republican talking point. They all want to talk about taxes. They're all going to cut taxes. They're going to cut it on everybody, particularly the middle class, who already, many in the middle class, pay pretty low taxes already. They're going to cut everybody's taxes. Explanation for where, you know, what they're going to do in terms of spending, nothing. So I want a Republican candidate who talks about spending cuts first and foremost. Deregulation and spending cuts. And I didn't see anybody doing that. So that's a big one for me. And not talk about waste and fraud. That's the standard line, right? The politicians talk about, if I were president, I could find lots of places to cut waste and fraud. Bullshit, right? Bullshit. I'm talking about real cuts to real programs, eliminating whole departments of government, like Ronald Reagan promised but never actually did. Actually reducing the size and scope of government. I want to see one candidate say that. And I'm not sure any of them have done that. I mean, Rand Paul has actually proposed a budget, which I think Ted Cruz signed on to, which cut $500 billion. This is the one issue where I love Rand Paul on. I mean, there are others, but this is one where I particularly like him. $500 billion from next year's budget, not 10 years from now, not 5 years from now, not over the long run, but from next year's budget. Now, granted, some of that is from defense spending, but I actually think you can cut from defense spending. We can talk about that at some future show about the waste and the real waste that actually exists in defense spending. But Rand Paul and Ted Cruz have been in the past really good on this. Will they have the balls to run on it during the campaign? Okay, what else? What else is there? Well, in terms of economic rights, the attitude towards the Federal Reserve is important. And here I thought Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, again, gave good answers on the Federal Reserve, not to abolish it, because I think that would have killed their campaign. That would have been a suicide thing. But, for example, Ted Cruz stating that to put the Federal Reserve on some rule-based, the fact that Rand Paul said that the Federal Reserve should not determine interest rates, those were good calls. Thumbs up to both of them on great statements about the Federal Reserve. So I was impressed with that. So economic freedom is an important one. Tax policy. We talked about tax policy. Foreign policy. Foreign policy is important, but you know what? And I'm going to go against the grain here. Now, if you're really, really different in foreign policy, like I think Rand Paul is at the end of the day, then it's important. But the differences between the candidates in foreign policy are minuscule, in my view. All of them are going to have the same advisors. All of them are going to nominate the same people to head their foreign policy councils, to head the defense ministry, the foreign affairs, because the only intellectuals who have a clear position on foreign policy on the right are the neoconservatives. So at the end of the day, every single one of the candidates is going to be a neocon, even if they don't start out as a neocon. You remember George Bush when he ran for president, actually ran as a fairly good foreign policy positions. He held that we should only enter wars if we could win them, and he held the Powell Doctrine, which is to use military force to win and have a clear exit strategy and so on. He also said we shouldn't get engaged in wars, we shouldn't be the policemen of the world, and a bunch of different things. And then as soon as 9/11 happened, and actually as soon as he became president, he hired a bunch of neocons to run foreign policy. And as soon as 9/11 happened, those neocons became the decision makers. So, and the neocons, they are the establishment. They are the ones that I don't care, even if Donald Trump gets elected, he is going to have neocons as advisors. So even if Ted Cruz gets elected, my guess is he's going to have neocons as advisors. Nobody's going to call me up and ask me to help out with foreign policy. Wouldn't that be cool? I mean, I can't run for president, but I sure would make a good foreign policy advisor to a president. That would be here's a job. I would take any one of those advisory positions at least for 3 months, and within 3 months I could decide whether the president was following my advice or not. And if he wasn't, I would resign. And if he was, cool. So there, we can lobby whoever becomes president next, Hillary or whoever, to give me an advisory position with the government. I mean, that would just be fun. It would just be fun. Even if they didn't listen to a word I said, it would just be fun to be able to say it in front of people who could actually do something about it. All right, foreign policy. We talked about foreign policy. Healthcare, a big one. And here I was very impressed with Carson. Carson was the only one who actually was willing to say, let's, in a sense, privatize Medicare. He didn't go all out, phasing it out completely, but he talked about basically a voucher system that would privatize health Medicare, which I think is a huge step forward. And a number of them talked about repealing Obamacare, but I didn't get from anybody a clear plan for what would replace Obamacare, because clearly our healthcare system is broken. You've got to fix it, not at all broken just because of they need to come up with a coherent, cohesive plan that they can run on. And let me make a side note here that is not related directly to the Republican candidates in the debate, but to the general failing and patheticness. Is there such a word as patheticness? I know there isn't, but the pathetic nature of the Republican Party. I mean, somebody once says that the Republicans are the stupid party, and it's much worse than that. They're stupid, weak, and scared of their own shadow. So why hasn't the Republican House and Senate passed a bill to privatize healthcare? That is, passed a bill that not only does away with Obamacare, but actually presents a alternative, a free market alternative to Obamacare. Right? Present a real bill that privatizes healthcare. Now, then Republican candidates could say, we're running on that bill. We're running on, you know, here's the plan. And this is what we as Republican candidates are going to stand up for. Here's what we as Republican candidates believe in. They haven't done it. I mean, it's ridiculous. These guys control the House. They have a majority in the Senate. They could at least attempt to pass it, but they're cowards. And it would make a huge difference right now, a huge difference if you could point to a plan that was the Republican healthcare plan. My wishful thinking. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back to the list of issues to use to evaluate these candidates. We'll talk right after this break. Don't turn the dial off, or whatever it is, the button off, or whatever it is.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrug evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence, and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten." Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Every day we hear from political leaders that the American dream is vanishing because of rising income inequality. The rich are getting richer by rigging the system, leaving the rest of us to struggle to get by. To save the American dream, we're told that we need to fight inequality through tax hikes, wealth redistribution schemes, and a far higher minimum wage. But what if that narrative is wrong? What if the real threat to the American dream is not rising inequality, but forced equality? In their forthcoming book, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, Don Watkins and Yaron Brook reveal that almost everything we've been taught about inequality is wrong. You'll discover why successful CEOs make so much money and why they should, how the minimum wage hurts the very people it claims to help, why claims of middle-class stagnation are a myth, and more. For more information or to pre-order the book, Equal is Unfair, visit your favorite bookseller or go to Amazon.com.
All right, we're back and we're talking about the Republican debates and the Republican candidates and how to evaluate them and kind of going over some of the issues that one should look at when evaluating candidates and assessing a little bit some of the candidates on these issues. And I was on healthcare. And by the way, call in 347-324-3075. I'd love to hear your thoughts about this batch of Republican candidates. Any Trump supporters out there would love to hear from you, or Carson supporters, or if you have any questions about how to evaluate them, or just thoughts on this year's election, 347-324-3075. And then you have to do something like press 1 or something to clear to me that you are there to ask a question. So looking forward to hearing from you. All right. Healthcare. I haven't seen a plan from any of these guys, so I'd love to see a real plan. And I'd love to see, as I said, Carson had what seemed like a plan for Medicare. Too many of these guys, particularly John Kasich and some of the others, were all about, we got to save Medicare. We got to save Medicare. It's not fair. Medicare's wonderful. Medicare's gone. All this crap. Wow. No, you don't have to save Medicare. Medicare is going to bankrupt this country. Medicare is one of the most immoral and certainly the most unsustainable program. But it's an immoral program. It basically penalizes the young, penalizes the able, penalizes the healthy in order to fund their grandparents' retirement. You want health care when you're old? Save money. So the fact that this Republican batch, I mean, they have to say it. I get it. They have to say it. Seniors vote. Seniors vote. But say something like, okay, we're going to preserve the benefits to the people retiring now, but we're going to phase this out so this injustice, this immorality never happens again. Something like that. Anyway. I'm in a Halloween mood. I'm trying to scare the bejesus out of you. Anyway, I hate Halloween. I mean, I like Halloween, but I hate horror movies. And around Halloween, all you get is horror movies, and you get them on television and everywhere. And I hate horror movies. I never watch them. I avoid them like crazy. Somebody asked on the chat, what would happen to drug price? What would happen if we privatized healthcare in the United States and they didn't in Europe and so on? Wouldn't drug prices still be expensive in the U.S.? Yeah, but they'd be less expensive, and they'd still be expensive. We'd still be paying for the fact that Europeans were socialists and using their socialism to drive drug prices in Europe down at the expense of Americans. But they'd still be significantly lower and better, and maybe we can find other ways to if we had private health care, we would live longer. We would have far superior healthcare to Europeans. We would become much, much richer. And we would just go na, 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 na to all those Europeans. So, we'd pay a higher price for drugs, but our quality of life would be so, so much better than it is today and so much better than Europeans are, that who cares? Okay. I want to touch on, two other issues that you have to consider when evaluating the candidates. And then I'm going to take a call, and then we're going to go back to these and talk about which ones are the most important ones, which ones are, if a candidate has a negative positions on, it's a huge no-no. You just cannot do it. Two positions and then one character issue. Okay, the two other things are, one is religion. Now, this is a huge one, particularly for Republicans. Now, they're all religious, and they all claim to be religious, and they all claim to be anti-abortion, and they all claim to do all these things. But the fundamental question to ask yourself here is, how serious are they? To what extent would they really encroach on our rights, destroy our rights? Would they really do away with abortion? Would they really do away with a lot of scientific research, which the religious right views as horrific? Would they reverse or work to reverse gay marriage, or would they work to reverse, school prayer or a bunch of other issues that we've separated church from state, would they significantly eliminate the separation of church from state? And I think this is an important one, a hugely crucial one. We'll talk about this in a minute. I know a lot of objectivists don't see the care. Big deal, abortion, who cares? Most of us are guys. A lot of us have already had kids or are married and don't care. But this is enormous. This is a huge issue of rights, but it's more importantly a huge issue of state intervention in ideas, state intervention in what we think and how we act on those thoughts. So it's very much connected to the free speech issue. I think if free speech ultimately is violated, it's going to be violated by some religious not. Now, here I worry about Ben Carson, who I think is legitimately really religious. He is one of the best neurosurgeons in the country, supposedly, and he doesn't believe in evolution. He's come out and said he doesn't believe in evolution. Strikes him as a mystic in a lot of different things in his, on the vaccine issue with Trump. Trump was talking about all these conspiracy theories about vaccines, and Carson wouldn't set him straight. And then with these supplements that he's advocating for, that he won't. It's not quite clear what his position is on it. So, Carson is suspicious, really suspicious here. Ted Cruz, I don't know how religious Ted Cruz is, but he's certainly playing up religion and playing to the evangelicals. And will he sell his soul to the devil by doing so? No matter what his beliefs are, will he owe them once he gets to become president? Again, don't know. But something we have to think about, you have to consider the fact that he launched his campaign at Liberty University, which is one of the most evangelical places on the planet. Big red flags, big no-nos. Huckabee and Santorum, they're off the charts. No way you could vote for them. They would be horrific. That no matter what else they say, luckily everything else they say is terrible as well. You cannot vote for them just based on how religiously fanatical they are. Okay, the last one is, what kind of judges would they appoint to the Supreme Court? And here this relates to the religion issue. Are they going to make abortion a litmus test for judges? Are they going to make other religion issues a litmus test for judges? Santorum and Huckabee certainly would. Would Ted Cruz? Would Ben Carson? So these issues. And then the final one is, I think character. What is the character of these people? Are they people who you would want as president of the United States? Would they reflect well on America, on business, on capitalism? And this is the big negative, I think, on Trump. But beyond the policy issues, but what about their character, who they are, what they represent? This was my big thing on Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton didn't do anywhere as near as damage as president on policy issues as he could have. I feared that he would do much more damage, I think primarily because the Republicans held the House and Senate. We had divided government. But he certainly did a lot of damage to the office of the president, to the perception of the president, to what it meant to be president. Now, how bad that is, I don't know. If the president is too busy receiving sexual favors in closets in the White House, and that prevents him from violating my right for the sex in the closet stuff. But that is an issue that has to be considered. Okay, before I kind of review these in terms of their importance, in terms of what I think about the candidates and what you guys think, let's take a call. And again, you can call in at 347-324-3075, 347-324-3075, and then press 1 to get on the question queue. Hey, you're on the Yaron Brooks Show. Who's this?
Hi, Yaron. This is Debbie.
Hey, Debbie. How are you?
I'm great.
Good. Where are you calling in from?
I'm from Silicon Valley.
All right. Good.
Yeah. So
what's in your mind?
Well, as far as religion is concerned, and Ben Carson, I definitely share your wariness of him. But I like to pay attention to candidates, not when they're speaking in kind of a prepared fashion, but when they're kind of asked a question and they're being somewhat spontaneous, to kind of get an understanding of how they really think and how they really hold their religion. Not that you can only, that you should ignore what they say in prepared policy statements, but I think these are kind of important little glimpses into their character. So Carson, after that shooting recently in Oregon, was asked, because apparently the shooter was asking people who's a Christian or something like that, and then shooting the Christians. And it was posed to him as, this is a real test of faith. What would you say in that position? And his response wasn't, I'll stand by God. No, his response was, I would take that opportunity to tell everyone in the room to rush this guy, right? And yep. So to me, that meant a lot to me in terms of his mentality, because after the shooting in Columbine, there was a girl who was asked by one of those killers if she believed in God, and she said yes, and then they shot her. And there were a lot of Christians who celebrated her for saying yes and for basically just sacrificing her life for a profession of her believing in a Christian God. So there's a big contrast there with Carson, and it does somewhat assuage my concerns about his religiosity. What do you think about that?
I hope you're right. I'm skeptical. I think he's very religious. I've seen him talk many times, and religion always comes up. And I think he's very religious, and I think his comment about evolution was scary for a scientist. I mean, you can hedge that. He didn't hedge it. He just said it outright. But I do share with you a certain admiration for Carson, and you know, I think he's a fighter. I mean, if you think about where he comes from, he's got the best story. And I wish he would tell it more often. I mean, he was raised by a single mother. He's not naturally very smart, according to himself. He works at it. He has to study, and he did. He was tempted throughout his childhood to give up or to join a gang or to just be lazy or to do something else, and he never did. He always went back and you know, reaffirmed his commitment to whatever goal he was trying to attain, and he worked really hard, and he went from nothing to being this incredibly successful physician, surgeon, and today a candidate for the president who's leading in the polls. I mean, it's an amazing story. So he's a fighter, and I love the idea of rushing the shooter, and I wish that would happen more often. And I know he was criticized by all kinds of people who said, you know, no, you can't do that. He's got a gun. But no, if these shooters are mentally unstable, they're not. I don't think they know what they're doing exactly. That is, I think they would panic if they were rushed. And I think you could overcome them. And I think at the end of the day, they would kill fewer people. So I'm all for this idea of rushing. So I think that shows that Carson I think he's really courageous, and I think he's a fighter, and I have a huge amount of admiration for him as a human being. But I worry about the religion. And look, at the end of the day, I don't think he's electable, because he has no charisma, he has no presence, he has no sense that he's a leader, and I don't think people will vote for him. But I do admire him greatly, and I think that we should focus on the positives in this case, and Republicans should highlight these positives about his story. And at the end of the day, I hope you're right, because I guess there's an outside chance he could win. And to the extent that he doesn't take his religion seriously, that's a huge plus if he does win. At the end of the day, this might come as a shock to many objectivists. What we vote and what we decide and what me, Yaron Brook, advocates for voting makes zero difference in this election.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that really makes me laugh is when people really get upset at me for taking a particular position. You're going to destroy the country. Let's say immigration.
If only you had that kind of power.
And I say, I wish I had that kind of power. But the fact is, our debate is purely academic. It will have no impact in the next 20 years in the direction of the country. Maybe in the future it will, and good for that. But really, you really think I have that kind of power? No, I don't. I know my limitations. So if I'm advocating against Carson and somebody's really for him, it makes no difference who I advocate for, except as a interesting mental exercise for all of us, which I think you guys like to engage in, and that's why you listen to the show. But it doesn't make a difference out there in the real world. I live in California. Who I vote for makes no difference. You live in California. You live in Silicon Valley. Who we vote for will make no difference. But I do think that who is objectivists we advocate for does make a difference in terms of the kind of movement we have. It does make a difference in the sense of how people will view us. If we choose some wacky, crazy guy to, and then make him the representative of objectivism in some way, that's not good for the movement. So I think whoever you guys advocate for, don't do it too passionately. You know, be reserved about it. You know, point out the negatives. So if it is a Ben Carson, point out that he's religious on certain issues and you disagree. If it is a Ted Cruz, point out the things that you disagree with Ted. Don't be all out positive, because much more important than your vote and how many objectivists you convince to vote with you is how the outside world and people on the fence view us as a movement and how we view internally ourselves as a movement. And you can do a lot of damage by being overly passionate about a bad candidate or a mixed candidate and without having the right caveats, particularly in a place like Silicon Valley, where the people in your environment are very secular. You've got to have the right caveats and make clear to them that by supporting a Carson or a Cruz, you're not supporting the religious agenda.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which I'm sure you do, Debbie. I fear that some objectivists get carried away.
Yeah, I think there's an opportunity, really, since there's not just one candidate out there, unfortunately, who stands for everything I believe in or very close to. You can still use this election cycle as an opportunity to talk to colleagues and say, well, I like this about this candidate, and I don't like that, and here's why, and, you know, things like that. So there are definitely opportunities. I agree with you totally, I don't regard my vote per se. I'm still going to vote, but I don't regard it as the most important or influential thing I can do this
year. Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. I think this is an opportunity for us to come across as rational, reasonable, as also realistic in terms of what's possible in the political world today, but as interesting people, right? We like certain things that Ben Carson says, but we hate other things, and we like certain things that Ted Cruz stands for, we hate other things. And look, we're not blind. You know, this is an opportunity to show the role reason plays in the way objectivists make decisions. And this is what I want to really encourage you all. To look at all these issues, you know, look at the candidates on all these issues, like some things, hate other things, and then when you present your position to the world, be nuanced about it. Present it in this way. Present it in a rational way, and this is an opportunity to show people, for example, that you're very pro-science, that you're very pro-reason, in spite of the fact that Carson is a seven-day event, you know, whatever. I can't even remember the name of the religion, which is some nutty religion. You know, that you can evaluate things, and that's our strength. That's what we want to show people. Debbie, thanks for calling. I have to take a break right now, but please call in 347-324-3075. When we come back, we'll continue talking about the candidates, the pluses, the minuses, how to evaluate them objectively. And I also want to talk about today about Paul Ryan, the fact that he's becoming Speaker of the House. How does that reflect on Ayn Rand and on objectivism, given his both support in the past for Ayn Rand, but also the fact that he threw under the bus 3 years ago. But we'll be right back after this break.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
When The Fountainhead was first published more than 70 years ago, Ayn Rand's bold literary vision and groundbreaking philosophy of individualism captured the world's attention. Initially rejected by 12 publishers as too intellectual, the novel became an instant classic and continues to provoke heated debates. What motivates a creative thinker? Is it a selfless desire to benefit mankind, a hunger for fame, fortune, and accolades, the need to prove superiority, or is it a self-sufficient drive to pursue a creative vision independent of others' needs or opinions? Ayn Rand addresses these questions through her portrayal of Howard Roark, an innovative architect who, as she puts, struggles for the integrity of his creative work against every form of social opposition. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who seeks to defeat him. The Fountainhead is as relevant today as it was when Rand first penned it. The novel was also a personal landmark for Rand. In Howard Roark, she presented for the first time the uniquely Ayn Rand hero, man as he could be and ought to be. Order your copy today in Amazon.com.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
Every day we hear from political leaders that the American dream is vanishing because of rising income inequality. The rich are getting richer by rigging the system, leaving the rest of us to struggle to get by. To save the American dream, we're told that we need to fight inequality through tax hikes, wealth redistribution schemes, and a far higher minimum wage. But what if that narrative is wrong? What if the real threat to the American dream is not rising inequality, but forced equality? In their forthcoming book, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, Don Watkins and Yaron Brook reveal that almost everything we've been taught about inequality is wrong. You'll discover why successful CEOs make so much money and why they should, how the minimum wage hurts the very people it claims to help, why claims of middle-class stagnation are a myth, and more. For more information or to pre-order the book, Equal is Unfair, visit your favorite bookseller or go to Amazon.com.
Wow, so I'm during the break, I'm tracking the chats, and there's some comments on the chat that I just have to respond to because I think you guys, some of you guys are way off and way off base. And I think these kind of statements are what off from objectivism. And let me say something about, you know, so there was a comment here and don't, please don't take these personally, you guys, because I know this is an internal group talking to each other and so on and stating. So somebody says here, all religion or death. And that's just all there is about it, because I asked something about how bad was Seventh-day Adventists, which Carson is part of. And that's true. When you boil it down to all religion leads to death, true. But there's a huge difference between fundamentalist Muslims right now and everyday Christians in America. There is a huge difference in the sense of the founding fathers, who some of whom were religious, and Huckabee today, who is far, far more religious than they were. There are levels of being worse and better and more pro-American or anti-American, more serious, less serious, and so on. So there are a gradation of attitudes towards religion that we have to take into account. Look, 90% of Americans or 80% of Americans take their consider themselves religious as part of an organized religion, and you can't dismiss them all, and you can't dismiss religion completely. That is, religion plays a role in human life, and we have to recognize that, and we have to be able to know how to address it a public day. I think most Americans are religious because it provides them with the morality and because they have some psychological needs that it seems to provide them for. So I wouldn't rule out the presidential candidate because he was religious. It would be a question of how much is he willing to bring that religion into the public space? How much is he willing to bring that religion into politics? How much is he willing to violate my rights in the name of religion? That's what I talk about. So, you know, you have to watch what you say about religion. You don't want to alienate people who might be open to our arguments. Okay. The other statements here are off on the flip side of this, and they're the Iran's statements. There are no scientists today, he argues. There is no scientist today. Science is gone. There's no. I mean, that's absurd and ridiculous and silly, Liran. It really is silly. And Debbie just called from Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley has tons of scientists there, and they are making major, major achievements in the area of science. Most of it's in applied science, but it's still science. It's taking the principles of science. But there are even theoreticians out there that are doing good scientific work. Good scientific work. Now, a lot of science is bogus, sure, but there is a lot of good science being done. And the idea that there's no science, either empirical or theoretical, that's worthy of the term science is just not true. It's just not true. And it makes us look like kooks when we say that. Now, it's hard to distinguish between good science and bad science these days, but that doesn't mean that you don't have the responsibility before you make statements about science to go and figure out what the good and what the not so good is. But there is major science going on, and it's not just engineering, it's science going on. And there is science in biology. There's amazing innovation going on in biological science today. And to say there hasn't been scientists since Newton, well, what about Darwin, or what about a lot of other scientists? But even in the modern era right now, it is not true that the science, all the science, now, there's a lot of science that's guesswork and just empirical BS, econometric and stuff. But there is real theoretical science going on in biology. There's real theoretical science even going on in some areas of physics. There is real application of that science going on in Silicon Valley. And to dismiss modern science completely is just as mistaken as to be religious, because it is ignorant. It is ignorant. So, there are a lot of objectivists in the world of science. There are a lot of people who evaluate the world of science, and it's just, I think it's a huge mistake. And it makes us look like cultist kooks that dismiss the whole world of science out there right now. And I view that as a huge mistake. There are massive abuses of science going on now, but not everything is abusive. Not everything is wrong. And particularly in biology, there are massive innovations going on, massive applications of the discovery of DNA, massive applications of evolution, both on the empirical side and on the theoretical side. There is really, really interesting things going on. And, and then there's the whole, there's the whole attitude that objectivists have towards what is science. And anyway, to the skepticism about so many other things that is just the good things are not guesswork. You wouldn't get such systematic good stuff just out of guesswork. But I'm going to stop with the hi. You're on the Iran Book Show. Who's this and where are you calling from?
Hey, this is Andrew calling from Africa. Great to be on the show. You're making some very great points as always, Yaron. Thanks for having me on the show.
I appreciate it, Andrew. So you got a comment on American politics?
Well, I just feel that, from my perspective, honestly speaking, various groups of people cannot create cultures of optimization, if I could put it that way, meaning intelligence networks, because everything these days, everything is communication. But theoretically, no one will ever be able to counteract the intelligence networks which exist without having intelligence networks equal to or better than those networks. So elections will always be rigged and or manipulated. You know, presidents will always be controlled to a certain extent. It appears that the secret secret operations, as opposed to open operations, are necessary for meaningful change on a large scale. Because that's
okay.
That's
Andrew, thanks for calling. Sorry, I accidentally cut you off there, but that was an accident. It really was. I disagree. I really do disagree, and I know there's a lot of people out there who believe this, and who think that politics is rigged, that everything in the world right now is being manipulated by intelligence agencies or by some cabal of some powerful people who are manipulating this. I don't believe it for one iota. I really don't. And I've studied, politics, and I've studied how the world functions, and I've been a part of an intelligence agency, in my military intelligence days. You know, what manipulates the world, what drives the world, what controls the world are ideas. People vote their ideas. It's not predetermined who is going to be elected. We get to decide who is going to be elected. But you did remind me of an important topic, which I forgot to list as one of my topics to evaluate people. And that is the issue of privacy. The issue of the NSA, the issue of the intelligence agencies listening to everything that we do, and using that to control us. So, privacy is an important issue here. I'm on Rand Paul's side on this one issue, I think Ted Cruz has been fairly good on this. Most of the others have been pretty conventional Republicans. Rah-rah for the NSA, supporting the NSA 100%. So I reject that. But that is another important issue by which to evaluate these presidential candidates. All right, we've got another call. You're on the Yaron Brooks Show. Who's this?
Hey, Yaron, it's Jonathan.
Hey, Jonathan, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Great show so far. I want to
calling in your own name for change. What's up?
I wanted to weigh in quickly on Donald Trump because obviously, he's caused quite a stir. I want to hear your perspective as well. In my two cents, for what it's worth, I think he's the worst and the most dangerous candidate in the race. Not just because, in my opinion, he's a liar and a complete fraud, but he puts himself forward, and the media does as well, as the capitalist, as the businessman, as the authority on business and trade. And obviously, anyone who knows anything about him knows he's just the opposite. He's the ultimate cronyist. So, you know, I rather, and I think I would encourage other objectivists to vote for Bernie Sanders, Hillary, or anyone else besides Trump, because he is the one who besmirches and gives capitalism a bad name. When Bernie destroys the economy, everyone will blame socialism. But when Trump does it, they'll blame capitalism, and that's why I think he's to be put down.
I agree with you completely, Jonathan, and I get a lot of flack from objectivists for having this view, because there's so many people out there who somehow view Trump as some Ayn Rand hero who is standing up to the man, who's standing up to authority, who's standing up to the system, and is a voice for capitalism because he keeps being proud of how much money he's made. But it's all hollow. It's all empty, and it's hollow and empty because of his character, because of the type of person he is and how he's made his money. He is. I agree with you completely. He is the epitome of crony capitalism. The Institute for Justice actually had a big fight with him, and I love the Institute for Justice. So the fact that Donald Trump went up against one of the issue, the Institute for Justice, is a sign of how corrupt he is. They went up against him on an eminent domain case where he was using eminent domain to steal people's property for his own benefit. Now, that should wipe out a candidate for the objectivist immediately. That should be enough. Now, I'm not saying that in real estate you don't have to go in front of boards of supervisors or city planners and convince them. And unfortunately, if you're a real estate developer, you have to engage in some level of cronyism. But some level is the key. Donald Trump has gone out of his way to engage in cronyism. He has gone out of his way to manipulate the system. And indeed, it was funny during the debate, him saying, look, I manipulated bankruptcy laws not in the sense of, look, the laws are bad, but you created them, and we do our best within them, and sometimes we manipulate them to make money. No, he was proud. He was like, I'm a manipulator. That's why you should vote for me. I manipulate stuff. I take advantage of stuff. So, you know, he is the worst of all worlds. And, of course, he's not a capitalist. Not, I mean, he's not pro-capitalism. I believe he would – he would stand up for the mixed economy. He wouldn't abolish Medicare, Social Security. He would do anything about them. He would kind of manipulate them as well. His tax plan is awful. He comes out against real wealth creators like hedge funds and private equity guys for their carried interest, for their taxes. He wants to raise their taxes. So on every issue, he is a pragmatic, middle of the road, nothing. And when he boasts about his wealth, he's boasting as a crony. You know, he's the opposite of Hank Reardon. Think of how Hank Reardon created his wealth. Think of the struggle, the effort, the energy, the mental effort, the engagement, the passion. Donald Trump does this as a you know, he makes Dagny and Reardon look like chumps because they didn't cut a good enough deal. He is, you know, he is the Owen Boyle. He would cut a deal with the government and make a lot of money. Owen Boyle was rich. Owen Boyle was rich, maybe richer than Dagny, maybe richer than Reardon, and probably touted his wealth all the time. But that's exactly what this guy is. And you're right. And I was going to get this. The worst, you know, given that we're not going to get a laissez-faire capitalist president, that they're all going to be mixed and they're all going to do bad things. One of the good questions is, are they going to destroy the good name of capitalism and the good name of freedom while doing this? And if they do, you cannot vote for them, because then the damage they will cause is long term. And that's why you can't vote for Donald Trump, because he would destroy the good name of capitalism, whatever's left of the good name of capitalism, forever. And it will take us decades to recover from a Donald Trump presidency. So I'm with you, Jonathan. Absolutely. I think he would be the ultimate disaster. And I urge anybody believes in true free markets and anybody believes in the relationship between the mind and wealth creation and believes in individualism, I urge you all not to advocate for Trump, not to vote for Trump, not to support him in any way, and to make it clear that we as objectivists, because we believe in wealth, because we believe in businessmen, because we believe in capitalism, because we believe in true wealth creation, that's why we reject Trump. That's why we reject Trump. It's actually a fantastic opportunity to make an important case for capitalism. And why Donald Trump is the anti-capitalist candidate, it's because of how he made this money and his whole attitude towards wealth and towards business.
Selfishness.
We'll be right
back. It is according to the moral principles of objectivism. Conventional morality tells you to sacrifice your values to satisfy the needs of others. Ayn Rand opposes that view and offers a new concept of egoism, an ethics of rational selfishness that rejects sacrifice in all its forms. In The Virtue of Selfishness, Ayn Rand defies conventional thought, setting out a philosophy that holds man as a heroic being, with his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life. Explore Rand's new concept of egoism and order The Virtue of Selfishness at Amazon.com today.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
For 30 years, the Ayn Rand Institute has been on the front lines of the culture wars, introducing millions of students to Ayn Rand's books and ideas, educating young intellectuals who now teach at universities around the world, and speaking out in defense of free speech, free markets, and free minds. You can join our battle for reason, individualism, and capitalism by making your contribution today at AynRand.org/support.
All right, so now I understand there's some audio issues in today's program. Let me say a couple of things about this. We use Blog Talk Radio, and I use it because it's just an incredibly convenient platform to use. A few months ago, they introduced something called Hi-Fi, and it was spectacular. That was the period in which we had the best audio sound, and unfortunately, it had some glitches for some people, so they took it off, and now we're back to the old lousy sound that they had. Usually, I dial in with Skype, but I've been told that this other method is better. I think this method is worse, so I'm going to go back to Skype next week, and hopefully, we'll have better audio quality. Let me just say something more about Donald Trump, because I'm getting some backlash on the chat, and I'm sure in some of your minds. First of all, Trump did do the eminent domain thing that he's accused of. I encourage you to look up Institute for Justice, and they're the good guys here, so I would trust them completely. But look, this guy is not – I'm not arguing that nobody who's engaged in cronyism can ever run for president. You can, obviously, in the world we live in today, you have to engage in some level of cronyism. But he is not ashamed of his cronyism. He's not embarrassed about the cronyism. He believes in cronyism. He advocates for the cronyism. He is the essence of what it means to be crony. Now, I'm not even getting to that idea of building a wall, which I think is absurd and ridiculous, and the anti-immigration stance that he's taken. I'm just talking about the fact that he makes capitalists look awful. And as such, he is going to long-term cause huge damage. Now, he's a complete pragmatist. So he's all about cutting deals. He doesn't believe in anything. He doesn't believe in capitalism. He doesn't believe in socialism. But when you don't believe in capitalism and you don't believe in socialism, where do you think it's going to go? Where do you think it's going to go? It's going to drift towards socialism because they have that moral high ground. And they dominate the intellectual debate. So Trump is going to drift leftwards as a president. He has no principles in dealing with Iran. He'll just cut a better deal. What does that mean? It means we're going to get the Iran deal, the same deal we have today. So, I think it would be a disaster to vote for somebody who basically says government power is unlimited. It's just a question of who cuts the deal. It is a recognition, it is a validation of pragmatism as a philosophical political ideal, which I think we should repudiate. I at least stand for free markets. I stand for individual rights. I stand for freedom and will now vote for a candidate who on principle and says so is anti-freedom. That's what pragmatism is. So let's go back quickly to evaluating candidates. So these are the things I think at the big picture on the principled level you need to look at. The fundamental is, are they going to do more damage than good? I think a Trump is going to do more damage than good. Let me say this because I get carried away here and it's dangerous territory for me in this. When I speak about candidates, this is me as an individual, Yaron, not as the representing the Ayn Rand Institute. As a 501c3, we're not allowed to make political statements, either in favor or against political candidates. So this is me as an analyst. I'm analyzing. I'm not telling you how to vote. That's your business. The Ayn Rand Institute has no position on these candidates other than to point out that they're inconsistent with Ayn Rand's ideas. But that should be pretty easy for all of you guys to figure out. So this is from the perspective, from an intellectual perspective of Ayn Rand's ideas of objectivism. I want you to think about what long-term is going to do us harm and what isn't going to do us harm. So presenting capitalism, presenting yourself as a defender of capitalism, and then undercutting at every opportunity is going to be incredibly destructive for capitalism long-term, for the perception of capitalism long-term. Right? Speech, I said before, is a crucial, crucial issue. So I would rank the candidates on free speech, and I would put a overweighting on this one, and I'll let you do it in terms of who comes out ahead and who comes out at the bottom. I don't think Trump comes out very high on this. The stuff that he said about the cartoons is awful, horrific, anti-free speech. And just on that basis, again, another basis, he would come out very low on that category. I think you have to think about Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court has very long-term consequences. So if you think a candidate is going to use religion as a major criteria for appointing Supreme Court judges, that is a big no-no. That is a big negative that you have to put. Again, rank them based on how much you think religion will play into their Supreme Court nominations versus, for example, how much economic liberty would play into their Supreme Court nominations, or how many of their Supreme Court nominations are likely to be middle-of-the-road nothings who switch to the left, which has happened to so many Republicans who have nominated Supreme Court judges. And by the way, that's a whole interesting – we should do a show on why do Republican nominees to Supreme Court drift leftwards. And I think it has to do with the fact that the left is more intellectual, that the left has the intellectual moral high ground. And therefore, a judge, which is by its very nature an intellectual profession, even if they're conservative, ultimately drifts left because that's who – that's where the debate is happening. It's where the interesting stuff is being said, and they have the high ground, and that's our biggest weakness, by the way. It's not politics. Our biggest weakness is in the sphere, in the intellectual sphere, in the sphere of ideas. The left dominates that sphere because it dominates the universities and it dominates the intellectual high ground and the moral high ground, and that is a disaster. All right, so free speech, Supreme Court, and then I would put the whole realm of economic freedoms, those are the three most important issues. Because as I said, I don't think there's much difference in terms of foreign policy. And here, in economic issues, I would include healthcare. So the whole realm of economic freedom, and I would rank them based on that, which again is not easy to do. It's not simple, but will be, I think is required, and rank them based on that. But I think free speech, religion/Supreme Court, and then economic freedoms, those are the three big issues that you should look at when assessing these candidates, and try to figure out. And I have to say, I don't have a favorite. whether as the head of the Ayn Rand Institute or as a private citizen right now. I really don't. And partially because it's too much work to figure it out. As I told you earlier, it doesn't matter what I think. I hate to break it to you. It doesn't matter what you think, and it doesn't matter what all the objectivists think as a group. We're an insignificant force still in the culture when it comes to politics. So I'm waiting for this field to be, you know, winnowed down a little bit before I really investigate much more clearly, you know, who's what and what do they really stand for and how deep it goes. You know, I think Trump and Carson are going to go away ultimately. I think this is going to be a contest between Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, and Ted Cruz. You know, and I hope Kasich is not. Kasich, if you rank him based on these criteria, he's the worst of everything. He doesn't believe in economic freedom. He is a compassionate conservative. He is terrible on the religion issue. And I think he's a pragmatist when it comes to free speech. So I would be very, very horrified by Kasich. I think it boils down to Rubio, Bush, and Cruz. And I think you all know my view of Bush. I mean, all you have to know is his family name. I think most of you know my view of George Bush, both father and son. And so I couldn't contemplate a third one. But I would say at the end of the day, it's gonna come down to Rubio and Cruz, and it's gonna be really interesting. I think it's going to be really interesting. And then it's going to be fun. Now, Carly Fiorina will be in it. I think at the end of the day, she can't win again. I love Carly Fiorina's one-liners. I think they're wonderful. I think she's articulate. I think she's very sharp on the stump. She's very, very sharp in these debates, and I actually like her. I just don't think she can win. And by the way, she's very religious. So for those of you who wonder, when she ran in California, she was very, very strong on her religion. Okay, I want to say something quickly about Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan just became the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and I view this as incredible, positive, and to some extent a negative as well. What's the positive? The positive is here's a guy who's clearly been influenced by Ayn Rand, who said so publicly, yeah, he's tried to throw under the bus, and he's tried to distance himself from her, but the label of Ayn Rand still is stuck to him. He never claimed to be an objectivist. He is not an objectivist. The left is trying to paint him as an objectivist, which is interesting, but he obviously is not, and he denies it, and I think denies it correctly. But he's associated with her, and here he is, in spite of being associated with Ayn Rand in one way or the other, he's Speaker of the House of Representatives. Now, that is very, very cool. That is something we should be very, very happy with. That is that fact that his association with Ayn Rand, in whatever level, did not disqualify him from being Speaker of the House. Maybe one day. And the fact that Ted Cruz, let me bring in Ted Cruz here, can read from Atlas Shrugged, he did it again a couple of days ago, and not be disqualified from running for president. That was unimaginable 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. This is a big step forward. Now, it doesn't mean he's an objectivist. It doesn't mean he's going to even be a good speaker. I hope he's a good speaker. But it means that the association with Ayn Rand is not a bad thing, as bad as it used to be. I'd also say this about Paul Ryan. I think he's smart. He's not very principled in his voting, and he's not very courageous, but he's smart. He often comes up with very good ideas, not ideas for laissez-faire capitalism, but ideas for getting us there. I like his idea about vouchers for Medicare. I wish he'd stuck with it. I wish he'd really pushed it. But you see, he doesn't do that. He doesn't stick with things. He doesn't push them. He puts them out there. If they get a lot of flack, he withdraws them, which is unfortunate. So I'm hoping he will encourage Republicans to come up with smart ideas, to propose them. But he's not a fighter, and that worries me. Okay? That worries me. So, and if he fails, if he's really, really bad as a speaker, if he does some bad stuff, it worries me that that'll be associated with Ayn Rand or his advocacy for Ayn Rand. So that's the negative side of that. But I think overall, I view it as a positive. I like a lot of what Ryan does. I like a lot of his ideas. And again, I think the fact that somebody can run for president and the fact that somebody can be the Speaker of the House with a known association to her ideas is something we should celebrate. It's a sign that our ideas are becoming, I hate to say this, more acceptable to the mainstream. All right, we're going to take a quick break here, and then I'm going to come back with a movie recommendation.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
In 1934...
Okay, I stopped the commercial because we're running out of time. And a few things I want to say. One is, it's true that what needs to be accepted is Ayn Rand's ideas, Ayn Rand's thinking, particularly her deep philosophical thinking. But you're never going to get to that point before Ayn Rand is recognized. And that Ayn Rand has ideas is recognized. And that Ayn Rand's, and maybe at the beginning they'll only recognize the ideas when it comes to politics and economics and maybe in ethics. But you have to get recognition before you get acceptance. You have to get recognition of some ideas before you get acceptance of the more deeper ideas. There is no way, and objectivists drive me crazy when they think this, there's no way to go from today to objectivism just with a snap of fingers. There is a transition. There is an evolution. And during that evolution, there are going to be people who like Ayn Rand on certain things and dislike her on other things. And that's a good thing. It's better that they like him as something than like her on nothing. They're going to be Christian objectivists. They're going to be objectivists. They're going to be all kinds of objectivists. None of them are objectivists. Don't get me wrong. They don't get her, right? But the fact of reality is that they will exist and that that is a transition period. And it's better for somebody to be a Christian objectivist than a Christian Christian. So a little bit of objectivism is better than no objectivism. In the transition towards people really getting her. So we have to think about transitions. We're not going to start from scratch. We're not establishing Galt's Gulch. It ain't happening. It was a fiction book. It's not reality. Ayn Rand didn't go to the valley. We are here to fight in this world to turn this world into a more rational, epistemological, morally correct world, which will ultimately lead to a better political world. But you have to think in terms of transition. You cannot think in terms of snapping fingers and it all changes in a week. You cannot think in terms of going to Galt's Gulch. That is a bad way of thinking about the world, which is going to corrupt the way you think about changing the world. All right. That's my little spiel on that. Two logistical issues. One, I'm going on a trip. I'm doing 9 countries in 15 days, starting with the U.S. I'm going to be in New York and Atlanta. Then I'm going to Serbia, Russia, Ukraine, Sweden, Denmark, UK, Switzerland, and Poland. I'm giving, I don't know, 15, 16 talks overall. I was thinking of taking my equipment and doing the radio show from the road, but that would be nuts. I'm trying to take enough clothes in one carry-on bag, and I'm also trying to have enough time to rest in between. So I can't do the radio show and do all the talks and do all the traveling and do all that stuff. So we're going to have guest speakers, guest radio talk show hosts or whatever you call it over the next three sessions. I don't know exactly whom, but we're going to have it. Now, in addition, the AM560 shows are back. They will start today. Live in about an hour, I will be doing AM560. They will then go up on the Blog Talk Radio website and through iTunes and everything. And I've already pre-taped the shows for the next 3 weeks. So you will get me all the way through on AM560. So listen to those shows. There's some really good stuff in them. Finally, a movie recommendation. Last time we talked about Martian. And I mentioned the fact that it is a good movie and I enjoyed it. And it highlights the use of the human mind. But it's not that dramatic. It's not that exciting. It's not that interesting. There's not enough conflict, internal conflict. And, of course, there are no other people to have conflict with. So I was thinking of a movie that does all that, that is man against nature, but also at the same time, it's man against man that creates a real drama. And not man against evil man, but man against mistaken man. And here, I highly recommend a movie called Flight of the Phoenix, which was made in 1965 with Jimmy Stewart. And I love this movie. I've seen it many times, and I recommend that you watch this. I swear often. I don't know why on the chat they're saying they've never heard me swear, but I guess I don't swear often on the radio, just at home. Flight of the Phoenix is about a plane that crashes in the middle of the desert, and the people there are going to die of, for lack of water. So the fundamental premise is a survival premise. It's like The Martian, but now you've got a group of people, and now you have opportunities for conflict between these people and for cooperation between the people, and you have incredible potential for real drama. And add to that the ultimate hero of the thing is a man of the mind. And part of the conflict is between two good men. The pilot, who is a man of action, but is basically a good guy. And this German engineer, and I won't give you the twist about what kind of engineering he does, but a German engineer who is a man of a mind, not of action, who is not very liked and is not a very nice personality, but a good guy, right? And a man of the mind. And to survive, these two men have to find a way to work together. Have to find a way to work together. So I think it's a terrific movie with a great theme and great drama, and it's exciting, and there's conflict, and there are other characters there as well who make it more interesting, and some people die and some people stay alive and manage to survive, and how they solve the problem, how to stay alive, how they get out of the mess. Now, here's the caveat. Do not, by any means, watch the remake of The Flight of the Phoenix, which is a horrible, horrible, stupid, disastrous movie. If you want to see a contrast between modern filmmaking and old filmmaking in terms of ideas, watch those two movies. But if you want to see a great movie, watch the old Flight of the Phoenix from 1965 with Jimmy Stewart. Do not watch The Flight of the Phoenix that was made in the 90s or the 2000s with, I forget the name of the actor, but a terrible, terrible movie. So go watch the movie. I'd really appreciate it if you emailed me or tweeted me or something, what you think of these movies, if you like them, if you enjoy them, if you agree with me, if you disagree with me, please let me know if you disagree. I try to point out movies that you might have never heard of, like The Flight of the Phoenix. That is not a very well-known movie, but let me know whether you like them. All right. I'll be back in 4 weeks. 4 weeks. So you've got 3 weeks now of fill-ins, and then but the Iran Book Show will continue, and then I'll be back in 4 weeks. AM560, though, will continue with a show broadcast live every week. Just three of them will be taped shows I recommend you listen to all of them. They're really good. See you in a month. If I survive this crazy European trip, including a direct flight from St. Petersburg to Kiev. Don't ask.